Welcome back to The Deep Dive, the show where we take the week's most important sources and really cut straight to the core insights you need. I'm Chris Vanderbilt.
And I'm Alex Astor.
And today we are plunging into the dense and fascinating financial and political world captured in Barron's Magazine for the week of September 22nd, 2025.
And I have to say, Chris, our listener provided an incredibly comprehensive stack of material this week. I mean, it spans everything from Federal Reserve policy and, you know, this renewed IPO frenzy,
right,
all the way to geopolitical tensions, new energy solutions, and even a pretty profound discussion on the structural integrity of American capitalism itself. It's a lot.
It really is an exhaustive collection. Yep. So our mission today is clear: give you a full high speed and deeply informed download. We're going to try and extract every key financial insight, every crucial market trend, and, you know, all the investment implications. The goal is ensuring you are completely up to speed on the macro picture, the political levers being pulled globally, and, of course, the specific companies making big moves this fall.
Yeah, exactly. We've structured this deep dive to flow, hopefully, logically, starting with market froth, moving to central bank policy, then into corporate strategy, and finally touching on global politics and some personal finance stuff, too.
Okay.
It is a lot of ground to cover, so let's just jump right in with what's clearly making headlines and driving a lot of investor excitement right now. The undeniable resurgence of the initial public offering market.
Okay, yeah, let's unpack this cover story, because IPO mania it's absolutely back after a significant hiatus, wouldn't you say?
Well, definitely. The numbers really speak for themselves here. We've seen over 150 traditional IPOs hit the market this year alone.
Wow, 150.
Yeah, and that's a dramatic climb from just 99 last year and only 76 back in 2023. So the trend is clear.
And it's not just the number of deals, right? It's the money being raised.
Exactly. This isn't just volume. It's significant capital. Companies have collectively raised $28.5 billion. That's a solid jump from the $24 billion raised the year before.
Okay.
But, you know, what's truly signaling this market euphoria, I think, is the average first day pop. We are looking at a 26% average gain on day one.
26% average.
Average, which is the best performance we've seen since those, you know, frenetic days of 2020. This kind of momentum, it just screams risk appetite is fully recovered, or maybe even overheating a bit.
And some of the specific examples mentioned are just, well, astounding. The sources highlight several really sizzling debuts: Circle Internet Group, Figma, Newsmax, Klarna Group.
Right.
They all saw these massive day one gains, some popping 30%, others ranging, you know, up to over 700% from their initial offering price.
700%?
Yeah, it confirms investors are aggressively chasing deals, especially anything linked to AI, crypto, or media.
But Chris, for every one of those spectacular winners, the sources are quick to highlight the necessary caution. You know, we see these tales of companies going public with what the magazine called, I think, inflated prices and shaky financial prospects.
Right. The other side of the coin, like StubHub.
StubHub, exactly. It kind of fizzled in its debut, closing 6% below its $23.50 offering price. That's not what you want.
No.
And Gemini Space Station, the crypto money manager, is now trading well below its IPO price, too. So it's not all sunshine and massive pops.
And the sources point out that this extreme volatility isn't just like a market aberration. It's kind of inherent in the IPO structure itself.
Mm-hmm.
Could you maybe unpack for us why these structures, you know, the small float and the lockup period, make IPOs inherently so opaque and unstable, especially compared to trading a regular stock?
Yeah, that's a really crucial distinction. Traditionally, pricing an IPO has been described as this sort of opaque art, right? Handled mostly by institutions, a few wealthy clients. But the core mechanic is really the problem. When a private company goes public, they typically only offer a tiny fraction of their total equity, maybe 15% to 20% for public trading initially.
Yes, 15 to 20%.
Right. So when you have such a small float available for, you know, price discovery, any slight shift in demand or supply just has this outsized effect. It can swing wildly.
Okay.
And compounding this is the typical 180-day lockup period.
The lockup, yeah.
During which all the early investors, the founders, employees, they're prohibited from selling their shares, which represent the vast majority of the company's stock.
Right.
So you have this tiny supply hitting potentially huge demand, generating that massive initial pop we talked about. But then you have potential instability 6 months later when that lockup expires, and suddenly a flood of shares could hit the market.
It creates this built-in volatility.
Exactly. It creates a wild ride. And CoreWeave is a perfect example they missed.
Right. The AI chip company, CoreWeave. Yep. They had that rocky start, tumbled below the initial price.
Mm-hmm. Really looked shaky for a bit.
Hmm. But then rebounded spectacularly. It nearly tripled its offering price, didn't it?
It did. And that dramatic turnaround was pretty much purely driven by sustained, strong AI demand and, crucially, some impressive revenue growth data coming out. It proves that, you know, the long-term fundamentals can eventually override the initial market noise, but it takes time and, well, strong performance. #... 1.2, the accessibility of initial offerings.
What seems truly remarkable, though, and maybe a bit different this time around, is how this opaque art of share allocation is maybe starting to democratize a little.
Yeah.
Historically, IPO shares were like this exclusive club, right? Reserved for institutions, bankers. But now it seems ordinary investors are starting to get a slightly bigger piece of the action.
The shift is pretty significant, actually. Retail brokers like, you know, Robinhood Markets and Moomoo Financial, they are actively allocating hundreds of millions of dollars worth of stock directly to their customers.
Hundreds of millions.
Yeah. And it's not just the brokers. The issuers themselves, the companies going public, are now often demanding that portions of their offerings be specifically reserved for the retail crowd.
Why are they doing that?
Well, partly because some studies suggest retail participation can actually help stabilize or even boost the post-IPO price performance, having a broader base of holders, maybe.
Interesting. And the way the brokerages allocate these shares, it seems quite different depending on who you use.
Absolutely. It reveals different philosophies about access. Take Fidelity, for instance. They're still relatively traditional. You need a minimum of, I think, $100,000 in specific investable assets at the firm just to qualify for IPO participation.
Okay, so still a hurdle there.
Still a significant hurdle for many. Moomoo, on the other hand, seems to be targeting more mid-range customers. They allocated over $1 billion in shares recently.
A billion. Wow.
Yeah, and they seem to view their approach as less constrained by just asset size and maybe more focused on frequent traders, active users.
And then there's Robinhood, which has perhaps the most democratic system of all.
Their system really is aiming for democratic. They use a randomized selection model for anyone who requests shares. Doesn't matter what your account size is.
Really? Random.
Random selection.
Yeah.
Their chief brokerage officer was quoted saying, "This approach gives everyone an equal likelihood of getting an allocation." It's a direct challenge to that old boys network on Wall Street, you know, explicitly catering to the smaller retail trader who historically felt completely shut out.
But this democratization, it comes with a risk, right?
Yeah.
The temptation for people to just flip the shares, buy them at the IPO price, mm-hmm. and sell immediately for that quick profit, that 26% average pop we mentioned.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And that flipping can just exacerbate the volatility we talked about.
So what happens if investors get caught flipping? Are there penalties?
There are. Brokers are actively, even aggressively discouraging flipping, which they usually define as reselling shares within a short period, typically about 30 days. And the penalties can be quite severe. They range from like a flat fee to a lengthy 180-day ban from getting any future IPO allocations from that broker.
Oh, 180-day ban. Ouch.
Yeah, the message is pretty clear. They're looking for long-term investors who might help stabilize the stock, not speculators just looking for a quick buck on day one.
So, okay, let's say you get shares, you wait a bit. Once that initial hype settles down, the reality of valuation hits, and it can hit hard. We're seeing some newly public tech stocks carrying just extreme multiples, Circle at over 130 times earnings estimates, Figma at 184 times.
Yeah, those are eye-watering numbers.
How should investors who want to engage with this sector, maybe after the initial craziness, navigate that kind of pricing environment?
Well, this is what we need to apply what the source is called the profitability filter. And this is a really crucial insight, Chris, that runs completely counter to conventional wisdom.
Wait, hold on a second. That runs completely counter to conventional wisdom.
Yeah.
What did the study find?
The study found that companies with positive net income profitable companies actually strongly underperform unprofitable ones in the first 18 months post-IPO.
Profitable companies underperform unprofitable ones. Why on earth would that be the case? That makes no sense intuitively. We need to dig into the mechanics of that finding.
It is counterintuitive, right? Because in that first, say, year and a half after an IPO, the market seems to be chasing pure, explosive growth, not stable profitability.
Chasing the story.
Exactly. Investors aren't really focusing on the current balance sheet. They're looking at the narrative, the total addressable market, the potential growth trajectory, the next big thing.
Okay.
The profitable companies, perhaps, are perceived as having already matured somewhat, or their growth rates seem too slow relative to the perceived risk and potential reward of the unprofitable high-growth bets.
So the market's rewarding potential over actual current profit in that initial phase.
Precisely. It's an appetite for risk and volatility chasing the next NVIDIA, not, you know, the next steady utility company. Which is exactly why that profitability filter is so vital for long-term investors who are looking for actual value after that first year or so once the dust settles.
Okay, that makes more sense.
Yeah.
So the sources suggest focusing on specific potential winners that look appealing after that initial noise dies down, companies offering perhaps more grounded value. What were the specific names highlighted there?
They gave three pretty strong examples. First was MNTN. They do ad monitoring on internet-connected TVs. It's expected to turn profitable by 2026, and it's trading at just 23 times forward earnings estimates. Analysts apparently see about 67% upside from current levels.
Okay, MNTN. What else?
Second was eToro Group, the crypto brokerage. It's trading at only 20 times earnings estimates, which is way, way below Robinhood's steep 72 times multiple.
Big difference.
Huge difference. The stock is down apparently due to rising costs, but analysts seem to view that as an overreaction, giving it a strong buy rating based on, you know, long-term crypto adoption trends.
Right. And the third one was quite different, not a tech play at all. Smithfield Foods.
Yeah, Smithfield, the big pork producer. It trades at a pretty significant discount, only about 10 times earnings estimates compared to rivals like Tyson or Hormel.
Okay.
So it's a much slower burn kind of opportunity, obviously, but one that offers clear relative value and maybe some stability away from all that tech froth.
Got it. And for those who want to play the IPO boom without owning the individual stocks.
Ah, well, the sources also note that the investment banks handling these deals, like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, are reporting significant pickups in their investment banking revenue from being the book runners. So owning the banks could be an indirect play on the IPO volume itself.
Okay, so we've seen this incredible froth in the IPO market. It's a classic sign of massive liquidity and, well, risk appetite. Mm. But where is that liquidity actually coming from? Let's move from the excitement on Wall Street to the engine room of the economy, the Federal Reserve. They just delivered their first rate cut since December, didn't they? Reducing the federal funds target range by a quarter point, down to 4%, 4.25%.
They did. And that move was largely expected. Chairman Powell framed it, I believe, as an insurance policy against decelerating job growth we've been seeing.
Insurance.
But, you know, the immediate action, that quarter point cut, is actually far less interesting than the outlook. And that's where this dot plot puzzle, as Barron's called it, comes in. It reveals some pretty serious internal divisions at the Fed right now.
The dot plot, that's the summary of economic projections where each member plots their rate forecast anonymously. And you're saying it showed an unusually wide range of estimates for future rates this time.
Unusually wide, yeah. The dispersion is really striking, and it indicates, well, a serious lack of internal cohesion, frankly.
How wide are we talking? What does it tell us about the reliability of the Fed's own guidance right now?
Well, look at the rest of 2025. The median projection is for two more quarter point cuts. That represents 9 out of the 17 members.
Okay, a slight majority.
Slight majority, but 6 members expected no further cuts at all this year. One actually wanted another hike. And then you had one outlier, Steven Miron, forecasting more than a full point slash by December.
Wow. All over the map.
Completely. So when the body responsible for setting the benchmark interest rate can't even agree on the near-term path, it raises huge questions about the credibility, or at least the certainty, of that median forecast itself. It's just less reliable.
And that uncertainty probably only magnifies when we look further out, like into 2026.
Absolutely. For 2026, the median call suggests only one more quarter point trim for the whole year.
Just one.
And this is despite policymakers simultaneously projecting stronger GDP growth, lower joblessness, and firmer core inflation sticking around 2.6%.
Stronger growth, low unemployment, sneaky inflation, and more rate cuts, even if just one. That doesn't quite add up historically, does it?
It really doesn't. This combination, strong economy, stable-ish inflation, and continued easing, is what some analysts are calling, maybe a bit dramatically, a failure of historical relationships. It doesn't typically happen this way.
Okay.
And this kind of disconnect leads to these historical echoes that should probably give us pause. This current easing cycle is being compared by some to Alan Greenspan's 1998 risk management easing.
98, right before the dot-com bust.
Exactly. That was seen as highly accommodative at the time, and in hindsight, many believe it significantly fueled the late stages of the dot-com bubble.
And there's another comparison mentioned, the 1960s.
Yeah, the 1960s guns and butter fiscal policy era. That was a period where the Fed eased monetary policy amidst really aggressive expansionary fiscal spending, you know, Vietnam War, Great Society programs,
right,
which ultimately preceded the debilitating inflation of the 1970s. The worry is, when the Fed cuts rates while stocks and corporate credit are already near record highs, it kind of feeds into this implicit market idea that the economy is too big to fail, potentially justifying even further asset price inflation. #, #, 2.2 cash, savings, and borrowing in a lower rate world.
So, okay, for the individual listener then, what does this new, maybe lower for longer rate environment actually mean for their savings and their debt? The sources seem clear that rate cuts are not universally beneficial for households.
That's a really crucial point. David Kelly from JP Morgan highlighted this for many households, especially those with savings. Fed rate cuts can actually reduce their discretionary income.
Reduce it? How?
Because the decline in the income they earn from their cash yields. You know, money markets, savings accounts often exceeds any corresponding savings they might get on their debt payments, particularly if they have long-term fixed debt like a mortgage locked in already.
So savers get hit harder than borrowers benefit, potentially.
Potentially, yeah. So savers really need to be proactive right now.
Okay, so the immediate wake-up call is probably to transition from just passive cash holdings, which are about to yield significantly less, to more active fixed income strategies. What are the specific recommendations for managing cash in this environment?
Right. First, and this is basic but important, avoid those super low-yield default sweep accounts at brokerages. Move any unallocated cash into higher-yield money market funds or online high-yield savings accounts immediately. Don't leave money sitting there earning next to nothing.
Check your sweep accounts. Got it.
Second, maybe consider diversifying cash holdings beyond just passive short-term treasury bills. The sources recommend looking into things like asset-backed securities, short-term commercial paper, and maybe higher-quality corporate bonds.
Okay. Other funds for that?
Yeah, the PIMCO Enhanced Short Maturity Active ETF, MINT is the ticker, I think, was cited as one example of a fund that invests in these types of securities. The idea is it might offer a potentially more gradual yield decline than traditional money market funds, which react almost instantly to Fed cuts.
And if you have cash, you know, you won't need access to immediately, there's a strategy for locking in some of these higher yields before the cuts fully materialize, right?
Yes, using no penalty certificates of deposit or CDs. Goldman Sachs' Marcus platform, for instance, was mentioned offering a 4.15% rate on a 7-month CD.
No penalty. How does that work?
The key feature here is that after the first 7 days, you can actually access the money without paying a penalty if some emergency comes up. So it allows you to lock in today's relatively higher rates for a bit while still retaining flexibility. It's a nice little tool.
Okay. Now, on the borrowing side, home buyers shouldn't necessarily count on a huge break coming on mortgages just because the Fed cut rates, correct? Mortgages track a different benchmark.
That's absolutely correct. Mortgage rates track the 10-year Treasury yield primarily, not the overnight federal funds rate. And there's just no guarantee they will fall dramatically alongside Fed cuts.
Right.
The sources even cited the example from last September, where mortgage rates actually rose above 7% even as the Fed was cutting rates. Mortgage movement is much more about long-term inflation expectations, bond market supply and demand dynamics. It's not just short-term Fed policy.
Exactly. But home equity lines of credit, HELOCs, those are different, aren't they?
They are very different, since HELOCs are typically variable rate loans tied directly to the prime rate, which does move pretty much in lockstep with the Fed's benchmark rate.
Right.
They become immediately responsive to these rate cuts. Their rates should come down relatively quickly.
Which makes HELOCs maybe much more attractive now for things like cash out refinancing to consolidate higher rate debt like credit cards.
Yeah, precisely. Credit card rates also tend to track the benchmark rate, but, you know, don't expect huge savings there. The base rates are already so high that a quarter point cut is, relatively speaking, pretty small in the grand scheme of things for credit card debt.
Okay, let's shift gears slightly to stock market strategy in this environment. The sources cite some crucial findings from Ned Davis research regarding how different sectors tend to perform depending on the depth of the Fed's rate cutting cycle. What's the key distinction investors need to grasp there?
Yeah, this is interesting. The key distinction seems to be the economic outlook that's signaled by how many cuts the Fed fears it needs to make.
Okay.
So if the Fed only executes, say, two or fewer cuts, like the median forecast currently suggests, it generally signals they think the economy is still pretty strong, just needing a little insurance. In that scenario, cyclicals tend to outperform.
Cyclicals being banks, tech, industrials, things sensitive to economic growth.
Exactly. But if the Fed is forced into making four or more cuts, it signals they see a rapidly weakening economy, maybe even a recession looming. And in that scenario, defensives tend to outperform.
Defensives like utilities, healthcare, consumer staples, less sensitive to the economy.
Right. Companies selling things people need regardless of the economic cycle.
Okay. So given the current division in the Fed's dot plot, you know, some expecting just two more cuts, some maybe expecting more down the line, investors probably need a strategy that considers both scenarios.
That seems prudent, yeah.
Starting with defensives then, if the economy does begin to sputter and the Fed has to cut more aggressively, where should investors look?
Healthcare looks like the primary defensive play highlighted. It's actually been the worst performing S&P 500 sector this year, believe it or not.
Really? Worst?
Yeah. But that means it now looks relatively cheap, trading around 17 times earnings. And historically, the healthcare sector gained about 20% in the 6 months after deep rate cut cycles began.
Interesting. Any specific names mentioned?
They pointed to United Health Group, citing its strong business diversity across insurance and services, and also Eli Lilly, where analysts view the competition concerns for its blockbuster obesity and diabetes drugs like Mounjaro and Zepbound as potentially overblown.
Okay. And what about consumer staples as a defensive play?
Yeah, consumer staples were noted as potential turnaround plays. Stocks like Campbell's Soup and Constellation Brands, the beverage company, look potentially undervalued, even despite some ongoing tariff worries for Constellation. Again, these companies sell necessities, so their earnings are generally less sensitive to economic downturns, making them potentially strong performers if the Fed signals deeper cuts are needed.
Right. Now, flipping it, what if the economy holds up? What if we only get those couple of insurance cuts favoring cyclicals? Where are the best cyclical opportunities cited?
Well, banks are seen as a main cyclical beneficiary if the economy stays strong and the yield curve steepens.
Steepens meaning short-term rates drop faster than long-term rates.
Exactly. That widening margin between what banks pay for short-term deposits and what they earn on long-term loans boosts their net interest income, their core profitability.
Makes sense. Any bank specifically?
Citigroup, PNC Financial, and Fifth Third Bancorp were all cited as looking potentially undervalued relative to the broader industry average right now.
Okay. What other cyclicals?
We should also look at small caps. Smaller companies tend to benefit significantly from lower borrowing costs, as they often rely more on debt financing than larger firms.
But small caps can be risky. Was there specific advice there?
Yes. The recommendation was highly specific. Focus on profitable, higher quality small cap companies to better weather any potential volatility. They mentioned the iShares Core S&P Small Cap ETF, ticker IJR, as one way to filter for this. Apparently, about 56% of the companies in that ETF are profitable, offering potentially a better yield and risk profile than just buying the broader, more speculative Russell 2000 index.
Quality focus within small caps.
Got it.
And finally, REITs were mentioned, particularly those benefiting from structural demand trends.
Right. Real estate investment trusts, or REITs, look potentially attractive. They're expecting earnings growth around 6% to 7% and offer a relatively high average dividend yield of about 3.3%.
But not all REITs are created equal, especially with office and retail concerns.
Definitely not. The growth areas highlighted are those least affected by those downturns or even benefiting from other trends, specifically senior housing like Welltower, well, driven by demographics,
bang,
and data centers like Equinix, EQIX, and Digital Realty Trust, DLR, which are both being driven by the massive, sustained demand for computing power from AI infrastructure buildouts.
Okay, just to wrap up our discussion on rates and portfolio strategy, let's quickly touch on the bond market again. Given that credit spreads are pretty tight, meaning investors aren't demanding much extra yield for taking on corporate credit risk, and the Fed's path is still somewhat uncertain, the advice seems to be look beyond single sector bets.
Yeah, move toward more flexible multi-sector bond funds.
Multi-sector funds, what exactly are those and why now?
Well, the strategy really emphasizes diversification and active management. Multi-sector funds basically spread their assets across a whole bunch of different fixed income buckets: government bonds, corporate bonds, high yield or junk bonds, foreign debt, sometimes mortgage-backed securities.
So they can shift between areas.
Exactly. It gives the fund managers the flexibility to pivot to wherever they see the best value emerging as market conditions change, rather than being locked into just one type of bond. They often allocate a pretty high percentage, sometimes 35% to even 65%, to high-yield bonds to help boost income.
Okay. Were there any specific examples of these funds highlighted?
Yeah, a few were mentioned. Touchstone Strategic Income, ticker TSYIX, I think, was noted for tactically increasing its high-yield holdings after some tariff volatility back in April, and it was yielding around 5.65%.
Mm.
The PIMCO Income Fund, PIMADX, was also cited for its strong long-term performance and currently has a large allocation to agency mortgage-backed securities. Its yield was around 5.69%. And finally, the American Funds Multi-Sector Income Fund, AMSFX, was noted for its consistency, ranking in the top 20% of its peers for three-year returns. The bottom line is, this kind of flexible approach seems essential for navigating potentially lower rates without taking on uncompensated risk in just a single debt class, especially when spreads are tight.
All right, let's talk tech, specifically chips. That $5 billion deal between Intel and NVIDIA, it's massive, right? It instantly shifts the competitive landscape in the semiconductor world.
Huge deal, yeah.
The sources suggest this deal offers Intel a crucial lifeline, solving, what, four major problems, but leaving one huge issue still unresolved.
Yeah, you could argue Intel was effectively in, well, maybe not crisis mode, but certainly under immense pressure. And this deal where NVIDIA purchased $5 billion worth of Intel stock as part of a larger $12.7 billion share raise Intel conducted, it provided immediate stability on several fronts.
Okay, so what are the four problems it supposedly solved for Intel?
All right, first, pretty obviously, they got cash. Cold hard cash, which Intel desperately needs for the massive capital expenditures required to try and catch up technologically with rivals like TSMC in manufacturing.
Right, building fabs is expensive.
Incredibly expensive. Second, they gained confidence. Having NVIDIA invest, following earlier investments from the U.S. government and SoftBank, it sends this implicit signal to the market that, you know, Intel isn't going anywhere. That's vital for investor and partner sentiment.
Okay, cash. Confidence. What else?
Third, they secured a better path forward for PC chips. Through a joint design partnership, combining an Intel CPU with an NVIDIA GPU, they can create chips specifically optimized for modern gaming and, importantly, on-device AI applications. Keeps them relevant in high-end PCs.
And the fourth problem solved relates to the data center, which is really where NVIDIA holds all the cards right now.
Exactly. The fourth, and you could argue maybe the most important win strategically, is data center reentry. NVIDIA's previous collaboration with Arm Holdings threatened to basically cut Intel CPUs entirely out of the lucrative AI server market.
Right, the Grace Hopper superchip.
Precisely. This new joint design partnership helps Intel CPUs stay relevant and included in specialized AI server configurations, ensuring they aren't completely sidelined in the fastest growing part of the market.
Okay, so cash, confidence, PC chips, data center reentry. Four pretty massive wins for Intel. Explains the stock's positive reaction, probably. But what's the doozy? The one big problem that remains stubbornly unsolved, hindering Intel's long-term comeback story.
Yeah, the doozy, the big unresolved issue, is Intel's foundry business, their manufacturing capabilities.
Ah, the plan to make chips for others.
Right. Intel's grand strategy under CEO Pat Gelsinger was to become a major manufacturing hub for everyone, including potentially even NVIDIA, competing directly with Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing, TSMC.
Mm-hmm.
But the sources note this is still lagging significantly behind TSMC. NVIDIA's own CEO, Jensen Huang, was quoted explicitly calling TSMC's manufacturing magic. That highlights that the technological gap in the most advanced fabrication processes remains immense.
So NVIDIA invested in Intel, the designer and partner, but not necessarily Intel, the manufacturer, for NVIDIA's own cutting-edge chips.
That seems to be the read, yeah. NVIDIA's stock purchase was an investment, a partnership vote of confidence, but it wasn't necessarily a commitment to become a major foundry customer for Intel's most advanced nodes, at least not yet. That manufacturing gap is the big hurdle Intel still needs to clear. #Tagtag 3.2 nuclear stocks and the SPAC resurgence.
Okay, moving from chip rivalry to energy solutions. Mm-hmm. The nuclear sector is seeing this enormous surge in investor excitement. It seems largely driven by the massive and growing electricity demands of AI data centers, right?
Yeah.
They need reliable, clean baseload power.
Absolutely. Nuclear is being firmly positioned now as a key AI energy solution. We've already seen some of the existing pure-play nuclear stocks companies like Oklo, NuScale Power, Nano Nuclear Energy. They've more than tripled, some of them, since their debuts.
Oh.
And now, riding this wave, we are seeing a resurgence of SPACs, special purpose acquisition companies, trying to capitalize on this nuclear excitement.
Okay, let's just quickly clarify for the listener. SPACs are essentially these blank check companies. They raise money through an IPO first, then they look for a private company to acquire and take public, usually much faster than a traditional IPO process.
Right. It's a shortcut to going public, essentially. Yeah.
But they have a historically pretty poor track record for investors, don't they?
They really do. We have to issue a serious warning here based on the historical data Barron cited. SPACs that came public between 2017 and 2022 returned an average of -61% for investors who held them for 3 years.
-61%. Oof.
Yeah. So it is generally a very high-risk route for investors. Caveat emptor, big time.
Okay, understood. Despite that historical risk, there are three new nuclear-focused SPAC listings discussed. What are these high-risk, high-potential entrants planning to build to try and address this AI energy crisis?
All right, the first one is Terra Innovatum. It's an Italian firm, apparently, focusing on developing these really tiny, modular, 1-megawatt cube reactors. They're about 33 feet per side, designed for remote locations or specific industrial uses. The concept is extreme portability, addressing localized energy needs.
1-megawatt cube. Interesting. Okay, who's next?
Second is Terrestrial Energy. They're designing larger 390-megawatt molten salt reactors. The hope is that using molten salt as both fuel and coolant will be more efficient and safer.
Molten salt? That sounds pretty novel.
It is, and the very novelty of the technology presents a significant regulatory hurdle, obviously. Getting new reactor designs approved is incredibly difficult and time-consuming, although they were apparently chosen for a U.S. Department of Energy pilot program, which is a positive sign.
Okay, and the third new entrant, Eagle Energy Metals, seems to have kind of a complicated dual focus.
Yeah, Eagle Energy Metals is fascinating and maybe a bit confusing. It's positioning itself as both a uranium miner claiming to own the largest mineable uranium deposit in the U.S. and a reactor developer working on a liquid metal-cooled small modular reactor SMR design.
Mining and reactor design. That sounds like an odd mix.
Analysts apparently agree, pointing out that the two businesses seem like an awkward fit under one corporate umbrella. However, their uranium mine alone is viewed as a potentially massive, valuable asset, expected to start commercial operations sometime around 2032. So investors betting on these new nuclear SPACs are really betting on future scarcity, immense future demand for nuclear power, and maybe overlooking the significant execution and regulatory risks involved, plus that poor historical SPAC track record. #3.3 Corbett Analyst Reports and Insider Action.
Okay, shifting back from speculative SPACs to more established players, let's quickly review some key analyst reports and insider activity mentioned in the magazine, starting with Apple. What's the latest view there?
Apple got a strong buy rating, along with a pretty aggressive price target increase to $305 a share.
$305? Wow. What's driving that optimism?
It seems largely driven by the expectation around Apple Intelligence, you know, their suite of generative AI features being integrated across the ecosystem. Analysts believe this will accelerate product replacement cycles, especially for the upcoming iPhone 17 lineup, which might include that rumored ultra-slim iPhone Air and also potentially redesigned AirPods Pro 3.
So AI driving hardware upgrades.
Basically, yeah. The narrative is that Apple's massive, incredibly sticky ecosystem, combined with accelerating services growth, positions it for sustained revenue expansion far into the future, justifying that higher target.
Okay. And what about Wells Fargo and Shake Shack? What were the calls there?
Wells Fargo received an outperform rating. Despite some near-term uncertainties around net interest income due to rate volatility, analysts seem constructive on the long-term outlook. They see strength in the bank's ongoing expansion in investment banking and also the strategic retooling of its consumer lending businesses towards higher-yielding products.
Okay, constructive on Wells.
Yeah.
And Shake Shack.
Shake Shack also got a strong buy rating. Analysts apparently believe the recent pullback in the stock price created a compelling entry point. They cited continued store unit growth and ongoing margin improvements. They even provided a discounted cash flow estimate, a DCF, suggesting a fair value way up at $160 per share implying a significant discount to where it was trading.
$160 for Shay Check. Ambitious.
Ooh.
All right, finally, there's an interesting insider transaction noted from Broadcom CEO Hock Tan, a $50 million transfer of stock. What was going on there? Why did he do that?
Yeah, Hock Tan transferred $50 million worth of his Broadcom stock into something called an exchange fund.
An exchange fund, what's that?
The why is pretty simple. It's a highly technical but actually quite standard wealth management move, especially for executives with huge concentrated stock positions in their own company. It utilizes specific aspects of U.S. tax law.
Sorry.
It allows investors to essentially swap large concentrated holdings of a single stock, like Tan's highly appreciated Broadcom shares, which were up like 50% this year, for units in a diversified portfolio of other stocks held by the exchange fund without immediately triggering a capital gains tax liability on that swap.
So it's not an outright sale signaling lack of confidence. It's a diversification maneuver that defers the tax bill.
Exactly. Think of it like a giant tax-deferred swap meet, primarily for very high net worth individuals. You trade in your highly appreciated single stock for a piece of a diversified basket. You get instant diversification, which is prudent risk management, without Uncle Sam knocking on your door for the capital gains tax. Yet, the tax is deferred until you eventually sell the units in the exchange fund itself. It's a very smart, common move for executives in his position.
All right, let's pivot now to geopolitics and global trade. We saw what seemed like a bit of a diplomatic softening between the U.S. and China recently. President Trump and President Xi Jinping apparently had a positive phone call and agreed to meet in October. That's certainly a welcome de-escalatory tone for the markets, I'd imagine.
It is definitely preferable to escalating tensions, but... and this is a big but, critical details remain very hazy, particularly surrounding the whole TikTok saga.
TikTok. Still unresolved.
Still very much unresolved. President Trump claimed progress, even suggesting approval of some kind of deal framework was reached. But the crucial sticking point, the core issue, remains the algorithm specifically, who controls the recommendation engine that serves content to U.S. users. China currently controls that via ByteDance.
And that technical control was the primary national security concern that led Congress to move towards banning the app in the first place, wasn't it?
Precisely. So the proposed U.S. framework for a deal sounds incredibly complicated. It reportedly calls for a U.S.-led consortium, including Oracle, to own 80% of a newly formed U.S. company that would operate the app domestically.
Okay.
This new U.S. company would then license ByteDance's core technology and try to somehow recreate that crucial recommendation engine algorithm on U.S. soil under U.S. control.
That sounds difficult, recreating the algorithm.
Very difficult, maybe impossible to replicate perfectly. And China's public response was notably less definitive than Trump's statement. They merely asked for a fair and non-discriminatory environment for Chinese investors and stressed compliance with China's own export restrictions on sensitive technology, which likely includes the algorithm itself.
So the deadlock over who actually controls the core technology, the user experience, that remains the key sticking point and a potential catalyst risk if a deal falls apart.
Exactly. It's the heart of the issue, and it doesn't seem fully resolved by this framework based on the reporting.
And this tentative progress, however fragile, could potentially be reversed by external factors, things beyond either Washington or Beijing's direct control.
That risk seems quite high, primarily centering on Europe, actually. The concern highlighted is if Europe decides to impose significant secondary sanctions on China over their perceived support for Russia in the Ukraine conflict.
Ah, the Russia connection.
Yeah. If Europe moves strongly, the U.S. might feel compelled to match those sanctions to maintain transatlantic alignment. Any resulting major U.S. tariffs or sanctions on China would almost instantly reverse today's tentative diplomatic progress. And one research firm quoted warned this could act as a serious negative catalyst for an equity market that is ripe for a correction. So the geopolitical risk hasn't gone away. #TagTag 4.2 crony capitalism and U.S. exceptionalism.
This kind of political maneuvering and the increasing use of government incentives and direct involvement in deals brings us to a really powerful guest commentary discussed in the magazine. It raises alarms about what calls the dangerous resurgence of crony capitalism and the potential damage this could do to U.S. exceptionalism.
Yeah, this was a profound and I think crucial critique presented in the piece. The core concern expressed is that the Trump administration, perhaps more overtly than previous ones, has crossed a potentially dangerous line by engaging in what amounts to state capitalism.
Saccade capitalism. How so?
By taking direct equity stakes in private enterprise, like the government and affiliated funds taking billions in Intel shares as part of the incentive package, and also by pressuring companies, like NVIDIA was reportedly pressured regarding TikTok, to funnel portions of revenue or grant board seats to government-favored entities in exchange for favorable policy treatment or deal approvals.
Okay. And the thesis argues that this kind of bespoke company-by-company deal-making replaces neutral, rules-based policy with political bargains, which undermines the system.
That's the core argument. It swaps predictable rules applicable to everyone for specific deals negotiated based on political leverage or perceived national interest, which can lead down a slippery slope.
But let's just play devil's advocate for a second here. If the U.S. is genuinely trying to reshore critical manufacturing like semiconductors in the face of intense global competition, especially from China's state capitalism and the heavily subsidized European Union, doesn't the government almost have to use these kinds of direct incentives, subsidies, maybe even equity stakes, just to compete effectively? Isn't this just pragmatic necessity in today's world?
That is the pragmatic defense, absolutely. And it's a powerful one. You know, we have to fight fire with fire. However, the commentary argues quite forcefully that the mechanism itself, the government picking winners, the implicit guarantees, the political favoritism is precisely what introduces the destructive force of moral hazard and inefficiency into the system over the long run.
Moral hazard, meaning companies take excessive risk because they expect a bailout.
Exactly. Look at the historical examples they provided to illustrate the dangers. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac operated for decades with an implicit government guarantee, which encouraged them to load up on excessive risk in the mortgage market, ultimately necessitating that massive $190 billion taxpayer rescue back in 2008. The moral hazard eventually led to disaster.
Right, and Solyndra.
Solyndra, the infamous solar panel company, it received over $500 million in federal loan guarantees, positioned as a champion of green energy, and then collapsed into bankruptcy just 2 years later. That represents, critics argue, the government's hubris in attempting to pick specific industry winners rather than just setting broad rules and trusting the competitive market process.
And the most relatable example they used of something becoming a permanent subsidy machine was Amtrak.
Yeah, Amtrak. It was created way back in 1971, supposedly as a temporary fix to keep passenger rail service alive in the U.S.
Temporary, in 1971.
Right. 50 plus years later, it remains a permanent, heavily subsidized drain on the taxpayer, having never achieved self-sufficiency. The commentary forcefully argues that this current trend of political deal-making, you know, trading tariff relief for specific investment promises, or demanding equity stakes, fundamentally swaps free open competition based on rules for bespoke bargains based on political clout. And that, the author contends, compromises the very foundation of U.S. economic exceptionalism, which was built on that ideal of free and open competition, relatively independent of state direction. It's a fundamental risk to the system itself, is the argument. #4.3 China's young consumers and global competition.
That's a really powerful warning about the domestic structure. Shifting focus globally again, let's talk about China's young consumers. They seem to be setting global trends now, even despite the ongoing economic slowdown within China itself. The sources called them the pivot generation. Who are they?
The pivot generation. This refers to the cohort born roughly after 1990. It's a huge group, about 400 million people in China.
400 million. Wow.
Yeah. They are the critical drivers of China's domestic consumer market now. But crucially, they are also the first generation in modern China to face real economic malaise, or at least significantly slower growth than their parents experienced. That guaranteed trajectory of constantly rising growth and wealth their parents saw, it's no longer a sure thing for them.
And this economic shift is fundamentally altering their spending habits.
It seems to be, yes. They appear to be pivoting their focus away from just having stuff, you know, broad material accumulation towards experiences and wellness. Things like travel, health-related activities, personal development.
Okay. Experiences over stuff.
Generally, yeah. They seem to be actively downgrading their purchases in many mid-tier goods categories, looking for better value, becoming more price conscious.
Yeah.
Interestingly, though, high-value luxury goods seem to remain pretty resilient, perhaps because they still provide a crucial element of social standing or aspiration.
So value conscious on the mid-tier, still buying luxury, focused on experiences.
That seems to be the picture. And these young, digitally native consumers are also incredibly globally sophisticated. Their preferences, shaped by this unique economic environment, will almost certainly influence broader global consumer trends far beyond Asia in the coming years.
The sources also drew an interesting distinction between China's innovation model and the U.S.'s model. Can you explain that?
Yeah, this is the distinction between 0 to 1 innovation versus 1 to 10 innovation.
0 to 1 versus 1 to 10.
Right. The argument is that the U.S. historically excels at 0 to 1 true invention, starting something entirely new, like the iPhone, the internet, fundamental breakthroughs.
Right.
China, however, is argued to excel at 1 to 10, taking existing ideas or technologies and then relentlessly improving them, scaling them massively, and iterating incredibly quickly based on feedback from hyper-demanding domestic consumers.
Faster, cheaper, better versions of existing things?
Often, yes. And this intensity, this 1 to 10 capability, combined with the fact that many leading Chinese companies are increasingly prepared to succeed without relying heavily on the U.S. market. It means they're going global very aggressively now.
Which means global companies, Western companies, need to be ready to compete not just with Chinese companies, but with Chinese ideas and business models, especially in third-party markets like Southeast Asia, Latin America, Mexico, Vietnam.
Precisely. BYD and electric vehicles is the perfect example given. They didn't invent the EV, obviously, but they used that relentless 1 to 10 approach to innovate across nearly every single component, battery cost, manufacturing speed, software, user experience, to create a world-beating product in terms of both quality and value that is now dominating global EV sales charts. Similarly, companies like Xiaomi are producing affordable, highly capable connected technology phones, smart home devices, with what the article called a blisteringly competitive value proposition for the everyman. Western companies really need a clear strategy to survive, let alone thrive, when they encounter this kind of hyper-competitive efficiency and value proposition head-on in those crucial non-US, non-China markets. It's a new competitive reality.
Okay, we've covered a lot of ground macro, trade, tech, geopolitics. Let's maybe look at a few more diverse investment ideas and lifestyle points from the magazine. Starting with a unique opportunity presented by MSG Sports, the company that owns the New York Knicks and the New York Rangers. The valuation here seems to present a huge, almost obvious discount.
Yeah, it's the classic Dolan discount, as it's often called. MSG Sports owns two of the most valuable franchises in all of professional sports. Forbes recently estimated their combined value at around $11
billion. $11 million for the Knicks and Rangers.
Okay. Yet the company's entire enterprise value, its market cap plus debt minus cash, is only trading around $5.3 billion.
Less than half the estimated value of just the teams.
Exactly. There's this enormous gap. And the discount stems directly and almost entirely from the control exercised by the CEO, James Dolan, through his super voting shares and his repeated, very public claims that he will never sell the teams. The market basically prices in the fact that the underlying asset value is unlikely to be fully realized for shareholders as long as he's in control and unwilling to sell.
Okay, so if the controlling owner is adamant about not selling the whole thing, how can investors potentially unlock some of that enormous trapped value? What are the strategies being discussed?
The sources outline three primary strategies that analysts and activist investors are reportedly pushing for. First is a minority stake sale in either the Knicks or the Rangers, selling off, say, 10-20% of one of the teams to private equity or another investor.
Would Dolan go for that?
Well, the company's COO apparently hasn't ruled this out publicly, and doing so would immediately establish a market benchmark for the true value of the underlying assets, likely forcing the stock price higher.
Okay, minority stake sale. What else?
Second, potentially splitting the teams into two separate, pure-play publicly traded stocks, one for the Knicks, one for the Rangers. Analysts believe these pure-play stocks would likely trade at a material premium to the current conglomerate structure because the investment story would be clearer, and perhaps the Dolan discount might apply less directly to separated entities.
Interesting. Split them up. And the third potential unlocker?
The third one is maybe more speculative, taking the entire company private. This option becomes potentially more appealing, interestingly, because of a specific tax law change coming in 2027.
A tax law change. How does that factor in?
Well, starting in 2027, a provision from a previous tax bill kicks in that will make the high compensation paid to the top five highest paid employees of a public company non-deductible for corporate tax purposes.
Okay.
In MSG Sports' case, those top five earners are almost certainly the Knicks' highest paid star players. We're talking massive salaries. So post-2027, those huge player salaries would no longer be tax deductible if MSG Sports remains public.
Ah, but private companies wouldn't face that same deduction limit.
Correct. That specific penalty applies to public companies. So, the looming tax hit might make the financial logic of taking the company private, perhaps led by Dolan himself, with private equity partners much more alluring after 2027. It's a complex angle, but one analysts are watching.
That's fascinating on the corporate finance side. But let's zoom way in now, from billionaire sports owners to an investment many of us overlook. Our own future peace of mind. There was a really interesting article suggesting people should start practicing retirement before they actually retire.
Yeah, this piece really struck a chord. It highlights that going from a demanding, structured full-time career to wide-open, full-time retirement is a massive psychological leap. It's not just financial. It often triggers deep-seated fears about losing identity, worries about inflation eroding savings, or simply concerns about staying mentally sharp and engaged without the daily grind.
Right. The what will I do all day question.
Exactly. And the solution offered by the experts consulted for the article is something they call retirement role playing.
Retirement role playing. What does that entail?
It means actively scheduling a dedicated retirement day, maybe one day a week or one full week per quarter while you're still fully employed.
Okay. And what do you do on this practice retirement day?
You intentionally fill that calendar day or week entirely with non-work activities, things you think you'll want to do in retirement. Getting involved with the charity, finally joining that gym class, pursuing a hobby, taking a local staycation, where you deliberately force yourself to structure and fill the hours without the default routine of a 9-to-5 job.
So the goal is basically to test drive your retirement plans and assumptions.
Precisely. The goal is course correction and pre-planning based on actual experience, not just theory. You might find out that your planned retirement lifestyle may be moving somewhere remote, or relying solely on hobbies isn't actually as fulfilling or sustainable as you imagine. Or maybe you discover you do need some level of continued work or structured activity to stay happy.
Like the example they gave of Tim Neer.
Yeah, Tim Neer, who found success by easing into it, cutting his workload down to just 4 months a year initially, which helped bridge the transition smoothly. It contrasts with others who might jump straight into full retirement and feel lost.
I think we all probably know someone who retired. It was just completely adrift after 6 months because they hadn't planned the life part, only the money part. That segment really makes you consider the psychological inventory needed, not just the financial one.
It really does. It's about consciously building a life identity before you retire that isn't solely defined by the title on your old business card. The contrast drawn was pretty clear. People who practice and plan the activity side tend to report being happier and more fulfilled in retirement, while those who wait until the very last minute often struggle to fill the void left by work. It's practical advice. #5.3 healthcare stock pick.
Okay, let's pivot back quickly to a specific stock pick mentioned in the healthcare sector, Option Care Health. Ticker OPCH. Why was this infusion therapy leader flagged as potentially undervalued right now?
Option Care Health is the nation's largest provider of at-home and alternate site infusion therapies. Think IV drugs administered outside of a hospital setting. It's a market that's projected to grow at a healthy clip, maybe 8.6% annually through 2030, fueled by patient preference for home care and significant cost savings for health systems compared to hospital stays.
Okay, strong market growth. Yeah. So why is the stock supposedly undervalued? Hasn't it performed well?
Well, the stock price has actually been pretty flat since about 2022, and the primary reason seems to be a specific challenge that emerged last year. The company expects a $60 million to $70 million hit to its gross profit in 2025.
A profit hit? From what?
It's due to a change in pricing for one specific high-volume drug they administer, Stelara, which is tied to provisions in the Inflation Reduction Act related to Medicare negotiations.
A regulatory headwind specific to one drug.
Exactly. So the market seems to have reacted negatively to that one-time known regulatory headwind, perhaps masking the strong underlying growth momentum in the rest of the business.
What does that underlying growth look like?
Well, their overall revenue climbed a solid 15% year over year in the most recent quarter reported, and their adjusted earnings per share were up 11%. Management is projecting overall 2025 revenue growth still around 13%, despite the Stelara hit. And they also approved a new $500 million share repurchase program, signaling confidence.
Okay, so the argument is the market overreacted to the Stelara news.
That seems to be the analyst view presented. They view the stock as a potential bargain now, trading at only about 11 times estimated 2025 EBITDA. That's earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. That multiple is apparently at a discount to both its own historical trading range, which was more like 10x to 17x EBITDA, and its current peers. The long-term growth story, driven by the structural shift towards home-based care, remains very much intact. #Tag 5.4 regulation and corporate frequency.
Right, nearly there. One final topic we need to cover is that regulatory debate President Trump seems to have reignited the idea of moving public companies from quarterly financial reporting back to semi-annual reporting. What are the main arguments on each side of this?
Yeah, this debate pops up periodically. It really hinges on balancing cost efficiency and management focus versus information transparency for investors.
Okay, so what's the argument for semi-annual reporting, the president's preferred approach?
The proponents, including the president, argue that reporting only twice a year saves companies significant compliance money preparing and auditing financials is expensive. And perhaps more importantly, they argue it allows corporate managers to focus more on long-term strategy and investment rather than constantly worrying about hitting quarterly earnings targets to please Wall Street, thus avoiding short-termism.
Right. Makes sense. Less pressure to manage quarter to quarter. What's the argument for sticking with quarterly reporting then?
Team Quarterly argues that reducing the frequency of investor information increases what's known as information asymmetry. Basically, insiders end up knowing significantly more than the public for longer periods. This could potentially erode investor confidence, maybe lead to bigger, more volatile stock price swings when earnings are finally released because the surprises could be larger. The SEC originally switched to quarterly reporting way back in 1970 precisely to try and improve transparency and reduce that asymmetry.
So, efficiency and long-term focus versus transparency and reduced volatility.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a clear winner or consensus on which is better?
Well, the sources seem to conclude that the debate is likely pretty low stakes, regardless of who wins the argument politically. They pointed to studies comparing quarterly and semi-annual reporters in Europe, where both systems coexist. Those studies apparently show pretty similar long-term stock performance and investor popularity for companies using either frequency.
So it might not matter that much in the end.
The conclusion seemed to be that simply changing the reporting frequency isn't likely to magically cure structural issues in the market, like genuine short-term trading behavior or underlying problems with corporate strategy. It's more of a procedural debate than a fundamental game changer for most companies or investors. #Tag outro.
Alex, that was an absolutely comprehensive sweep, I have to say. We covered the entire financial landscape presented in this week's Barron's. We navigated everything from that massive froth and somewhat counterintuitive risk profile in the IPO frenzy.
Right, all the way to the highly divided Federal Reserve dot plot and what that uncertainty means for rates and sector strategy.
And we broke down the complexities of that big NVIDIA-Intel alliance, assessed the really profound political risks potentially posed by bespoke corporate deals and this idea of crony capitalism.
Mm-hmm. And explored how China's pivot generation is actively reshaping not just domestic consumption, but global consumer demands and competitive innovation strategy worldwide.
It is a huge amount of data and insight to digest, but hopefully you, the listener, now have the key context and the potential implications drawn from these highest level sources. But before we sign off, I do want to leave you with one final, maybe provocative thought. It's something we touched on early in the bond section, and it challenges a really fundamental tenet of Finance 101.
Yes. This is about the core, almost unquestioned belief that sovereign debt, you know, U.S. Treasuries, other major government bonds, is essentially risk-free. That foundational assumption is being seriously questioned by some of the research highlighted this week.
Indeed. Look at the facts. Government debt has absolutely surged globally. The U.S. deficit is currently running at a concerning 6% of GDP. France, a major European economy, recently saw its government bonds yielding higher than some well-rated corporate debt from fringe companies. That's upside down.
Right. And the U.S. even lost one of its top AAA credit ratings earlier this year from a major agency. So the risk-free status is already slightly tarnished. Conversely, corporate balance sheets, in aggregate, have actually been relatively stable, even improving in some sectors, partly because many companies wisely locked in super low borrowing rates years ago.
So here's the provocative assertion from BCA Research mentioned in the piece. They are suggesting that high-quality, investment-grade corporate bonds might now be the real functional risk-free rate in the market, not necessarily sovereign debt anymore.
The implication is really profound if you accept that premise. It means that the traditional market benchmark for bonds, the Bloomberg Aggregate Bond Index, is actually heavily skewed towards government debt simply because Washington has issued so much of it due to its profligacy, not necessarily because government debt represents the safest or healthiest part of the overall fixed income market today.
So the question we want to leave you mulling over is this. do you still fundamentally believe that sovereign debt is the true risk-free asset anchor for your portfolio? Or, in a world of ballooning government debt and relatively healthier corporate balance sheets, should you perhaps be thinking about diversifying away from treasuries to some extent and maybe even rethinking your entire fixed income benchmark? It's a fundamental challenge to how we've all been taught to view portfolio construction.
Definitely something to mull over as you build and review your own long-term strategy. Thank you so much for joining us for this deep dive into the sources this week. We genuinely hope you feel thoroughly informed and perhaps better equipped to act on some of this week's critical insights.
Absolutely. Until next time, stay curious, stay critical, and stay well informed.